Okay, let's start. Good afternoon, week 12. And today's topic is pragmatics, or a bit of a more digestible title here, How to Do Things with Words. How to Do Things with Words is a famous title of a series of lectures that Austin held, and that basically started off a lot of research in pragmatics. So that's why I chose this as the title for today's lecture. As usual, some admin first. There's only one point. The second assignment, which is, as you know, obligatory for all BA students. So if you're a BA Hauptfach or BA Nebenfach student, then this is something that you'll be expected to do, is now online. And I'd like to say a few words about this. Well, apart from that, it's only obligatory for BA students, and that it has to be submitted to Frau Thielen by the 7th of February at 11 a.m., which is when her office hours finishes, in room B315. Now, what I've in fact in the end decided to do, because that would, I felt, be the best way to prepare you for the exam, is give you a complete past exam, okay, so that you know exactly what to expect from a past exam. That means you don't only get the six questions, sort of basic questions at the beginning, the short ones, but you also get the essay question. I know that a few people were a bit worried about what it means to do, well, what is this essay question? The idea is basically that you have a choice between two topics, and you then write a short paragraph or two. It says write one paragraph. If you write two paragraphs, that's not a catastrophe either. And it says 100 to 150 words. In the exam, it'll only give you space on one page. I now wrote on the assignment, if you've seen it already, you can use the reverse side of the page. The idea, however, is not that you then fill the whole page. Try to stick to the word limit, but, and I'll say it again, particularly for the exam, don't waste time counting words. Okay? Get an idea about what 150 or 100 words looks like, and then don't even start counting, because I will do a lot of other things, but I will not count the words that you have written. And you will not get a better mark if you did exactly 150 words rather than only 147. Okay. Last year I actually saw people frantically counting. Not necessary, really not. Okay. So there is a choice of two topics. This is virtually the same as one of the exams as that we did last year. The only thing is that I chose a question for which you need lecture 14 or something like that, and I exchanged it with something else that you can already answer. It wouldn't have made sense. I would recommend that you do this on your own, possibly even without consulting too many books, too much of the reading that you've done, or the lecture slides, simply because this will give you an idea of what you still need to revise for the exam. The actual outcome, I mean, you will be given a mark at the end for the assessment, but this is purely to give you an idea that if this was the exam, then that would have been your mark. It doesn't count for anything in terms of the final grade for this course or for the module. It's just basically the idea that you know where you stand. Okay. Yes, and because of that, it's probably better if you do it on your own and with as little help as possible. Okay. Good. So I would suggest we go and start straight with some linguistics now. And I think one of the questions I'd like to ask at the very beginning, well, not ask and ask for responses, but maybe you can ask yourself, what we use language for. And I think one of the standard responses that you would get, particularly when you go and ask the layperson out on the street, well, to convey information. Okay? Language is used to inform people about other things. Notice that I've put a question mark there. Okay. Yes, we can use language to convey information. I can, for example, tell you, If you ask me, and I'm the person who knows about the times of the train will leave at 11:24 from platform 7. Okay. And that's then, well, then you go away and you have more information than you had before. Fine. In fact, afterwards, we can say the train left at 11:24 from platform 7, and we can know whether that's true or not. Okay. Or whether there was a delay, depending on what you count as being late. Okay. So, yes, you can say it was true or it wasn't true. Okay. But is that really the only reason why we use language? And of course, if I ask like that, then the answer is no. We use language for all sorts of other things. To be sociable, we do small talk, we do all sorts of things with language that has to do with our sort of interpersonal relations. That's what we use it for. But the other question, of course, is how do we do this? And how do we convey information that may be not necessarily only about whether the train left or not, but perhaps we need to ask in a more general term, how do we communicate with language, or how do we communicate meaning with language? And that's basically what the lecture is about today. It's the first in a series of two lectures that have to do with the larger topic of pragmatics. Next time we will be looking at politeness, which has relatively little to do with lay politeness, with being polite, with opening doors for people, or with, I don't know, getting up from your seat in the bus when someone else comes in who can't stand. You know what I mean. Okay, that's not really what I'll be talking about when I'll be talking about linguistic politeness, although, of course, it is to some extent related. But today you get the basics. You get the basics of speech act theory. You get the basics of how we make sense of what we say, even though it looks as if it doesn't really make all that much sense. Okay. But more later. I hereby pronounce you husband and wife. Okay, I could have chosen two of you, one male and one female, and I would have walked up to you and said, I hereby pronounce you husband and wife. Okay. Well, I've already raised a problem here because, I mean, the next thing doesn't really match with this. By uttering this sentence, an action is performed. Really? Okay, well, if it is said in the right context, then actually an action is performed. I mean, that truly something is happening, okay, in the sense of there is a legal bond or whatever, okay, that is performed by uttering those words. Okay. Now, can we say that this is true or false? Well, it's basically something that's done. It's not true or false. It doesn't really apply. We cannot evaluate this utterance in the same way as saying the train was late. Okay? In the same sense, well, we can say it happened, but that's all. Okay. It is more important to ask the question whether the necessary conditions have been fulfilled, okay? Or were the conditions appropriate. So if I walked up to you, as I said, and tried to marry two of you, you wouldn't be married. Okay. You wouldn't be married for various reasons. Number one, I'm not the right person. And number two, you probably don't want to get married. I don't know. Maybe, but maybe not to the person next to you. And we're not in a church. There are all sorts of things that are not fulfilled in order for that particular utterance, I hereby pronounce you husband and wife, to be successful. So what does it have to be in order to be successful? I would have had to be qualified to solemnize the marriage. The circumstances must be appropriate. Okay. We must execute the whole procedure, okay, fully and correctly, so correctly and completely. And in fact, you could even say that you must really want it. Okay. Is it successful if you never had the intention of getting married? So let's have a quick look first at some of the, I mean, that it has to be fully, that it has to be done and fully and completely and in the right way. Here is what the priest says. Whoever, N name, okay. Wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honor, and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, keep thee unto her, so long as ye both shall live? It's one version, slightly more old-fashioned version. It's basically variations on the same theme. Bridegroom says, yes. Is that now complete? This is not according to the actual script. The bridegroom is supposed to say, I will. Okay? And you could, this would cause problems, right? Because it's not actually been 100% complete, one could claim. Okay. The bit about wanting to get married and then perhaps the whole thing not being successful is nicely demonstrated in this clip from a newspaper, from a Swiss newspaper, and I'll quickly read this to you. This is in German. Jux Hochzeit ist ungültig. Eine im oberbayerischen Kreiburg aus Spaß geschlossene Ehe hat für die beiden Partner doch keine ernsthaften Folgen. Das Landratsamt erklärte den Lebensbund am Montag offiziell für ungültig. Im August hatte Bürgermeister Aris Schlagmann, laut Zeitungsberichten, nach einer feuchtfröhlichen Geburtstagsfeier der Festgemeinschaft des Rathaus gezeigt und dort spaßeshalber eine Trauungszeremonie vorgenommen. Da der Bürgermeister auch als Standesbeamter tätig sein kann, war zunächst unklar, ob es sich um eine gültige Ehe handelte. Das vermeintliche Brautpaar und die Zeugen haben schriftlich erklärt, dass keine Eheschließung stattgefunden hat, sagte der zuständige Sachgebietsleiter im Landratsamt. My English is better than my German. Landratsamt Mühldorf, Erich Kotel. Damit ist die Sache für uns erledigt. Andernfalls hätte sich das Brautpaar erst nach einem Trennungsjahr wieder scheiden lassen können. So we're really talking about actions being performed by doing the right thing in the right circumstances, actions that may have an implication on your life, on well, things were actually happening. Okay. Here's another example of how saying the wrong thing in the right place, saying the wrong thing can actually set off a number of things that you don't want. Okay. Man fined for making bomb joke on board a Silk Air aircraft. An Australian man has been fined 10,000 Singapore dollars, about 3,000 pounds, about, I don't know, 3,700 euros or a bit more, 4,000, under international anti-terrorism regulations after making a joke about the bomb on board a Silk Air flight. The man was looking for hand luggage space on board the Silk Air aircraft on a flight bound for Indonesia when he asked the flight attendant, where do you keep the bomb? According to the Straits Times, the pilot was informed of the incident, after which the man was removed from the aircraft and later charged with raising a false alarm about a terrorist act. The man had faced up to 5 years in jail and the maximum of 100,000 Singapore dollars fine, although he told the court his comment was meant as a joke. Okay. Right, enough sort of explanation of the fact or for the fact or examples to show that you can actually do something with language rather than just inform people. But one point I would like to make now is, what did that person actually do? He asked the question, where do you keep the bomb? Okay. Now, I will return to the question of form later on, but, I mean, this is basically a question. It's nothing more. In the form, it's a question. But it still seemed to have done something or set a number of things off that are incompatible with the way it was interpreted, namely as a bomb threat. Okay. So it seems to be that what's done with language and the results it might have doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the form. In this case, it's a question. Okay. Right, but let's go back to the basics. I'll give you some more examples of speech acts, in the sense of that by uttering this, you're actually doing something. I declare the meeting open. If you're the right person, if you're chairing the meeting, then the meeting will be open. If, I don't know, the person taking notes, whatever, says it, then the meeting will not be open because the appropriateness conditions are not fulfilled. I name the ship Victoria. That actually performs an action of naming the ship. I sentence you to life imprisonment. Quite clearly a rather drastic, well, action that's being performed here. And again, of course, the right person has to utter it in this, in the right context. If you, I don't know, don't hand in the assignment and I say I sentence you to life imprisonment, then you just smile at me and walk away. I apologize for deceiving you. Okay. This performs the speech act of an apology by uttering the words, you apologize. And in fact, there is a very simple test to check whether an action is actually performed. You can reformulate all those sentences by adding the word hereby. Okay, I hereby declare the meeting open, I hereby name the ship Victoria, etc., etc. When you can do this, then this is a good test for whatever the utterance is, well, whether this is a direct speech act or not. Notice that you cannot do this with all verbs. You can do it with declare, you can do it with name, but you cannot do it with insult. You cannot say, I hereby insult you. You can insult someone, of course, with language, but you cannot say that insult is a verb which, by uttering the verb, performs the action, or in other words, a performative verb. Okay. Right, so there is no English verb, insult, that performs the action of insulting. But as I said, you can clearly insult someone, of course, we all know that. Okay. Here's a little cartoon that works on that, basically makes use of that fact. Okay. Nothing is more fierce than my hatred for cats. I despise the very ground on which they walk. Okay. And he's sniffing, seems to have sniffed a cat, or at least a trace of a cat. I do believe a cat has walked along here. Yes, I'm sure of it. I hereby despise this ground. Okay. Can you do this? You cannot hereby despise. You cannot hereby insult. But of course, you can hereby apologize. So, if I say, I hereby apologize for uploading something too late to SUDIP, then I'm actually apologizing. Now, as I've already said at the very beginning when I explained the title of the lecture, this all goes back to Austin in the 1950s, a philosopher, okay, not a linguist, who the series of lectures was then later published as How to Do Things with Words. And he came up with this idea, at least at the beginning of his lectures, of this series of lectures, that there is this class of verbs which he called performatives. So, the purpose of uttering these words, or these verbs, is to perform the action. But then later on in the lecture, he notices that things are not quite as easy as that. But let's have a quick look at those verbs first. I've already given you a few. There's only one here. I promise to give you the money back tomorrow. Okay. By uttering the word promise, the verb promise, I perform the promise. But as I said, he very quickly noticed that we can also promise, or we can also threaten, or whatever, or apologize, in different ways. We do not need the word promise. We can say, I'll give you the money back tomorrow. Sure. Performs the same action. Okay. However, the word promise isn't uttered, and we still interpret it as a promise. I warn you that a bull is about to attack you. Okay. This is a very silly thing to say if the bull is just sort of 10 meters behind the person being attacked. Okay. You do not say, I hereby warn you that a bull is about to... Oh, sorry, too late. What do? You shout, bull, or whatever. Yeah. Same action is being performed. The only difference is it's probably more successful. Okay. So, quite clearly, the idea that there are certain parts of language which can be used to perform an action, and there are other parts of language which we use to convey information, doesn't quite hold. Okay? It's not quite as easy as that. We can perform actions without using these explicit performative verbs. Now, in fact, Austin then went on to conclude that everything we say, every utterance, is an action. Okay? All utterances are speech acts. There are lots of different ones, and no, you do not need to learn all of those by heart. Requests, commands, apologies, threats, compliments, warnings, advice, and assertions. Statements, one could say. Okay? Assertions. So, the train left at 11:24 from platform 7 is a speech act in the sense that I perform the speech act of asserting something. So this whole distinction between performative verbs and other verbs doesn't really hold. Okay? Now in linguistics we typically, or people who do speech act analysis or typically distinguish between three types of act or acts. Okay. The locutionary act, this is also in the reading that you've done, as far as I remember. The locutionary act, namely the utterance of a sentence with determinate sense and reference. One could say the basic content, the basic word-based meaning put together, sort of the basic propositional content of the words that and the sentence that is formed out of those words. The direct meaning. The next one is the illocutionary act. For example, the making of a statement, offer, promise, etc., in uttering a sentence by virtue of the, and this will become clearer later, conventional force associated with it. And then there is the perlocutionary act. That's actually the effect that this has on the hearer, on the audience, the bringing about of effects on the audience by means of uttering the sentence, such effects being special to the circumstances of the utterance. Okay. I'll be particularly looking at illocution and locution. Perlocution will be less important here. Good. I made the point that this poor passenger of Silk Air asked a question. Okay, and I already said that in itself the question isn't really related to this being a bomb threat. Okay, it was interpreted as such. So maybe it makes sense to look a little bit more at the form of individual speech acts and what they do, the force of them, what they perform. If you shout at someone, finish the lecture, then that's in the form of an imperative. The sentence type is imperative. Okay? It's not a declarative, it's an imperative. Okay? And the speech act is a command, very clearly. Okay? You want them, or me, or whatever, to stop lecturing. Have you finished the lecture? Okay? That's an interrogative. And it performs what? Well, it performs a question. You want to know? Let's presume you want to know. And you then probably get an answer. No, I haven't yet. Sorry, you'll have to be here for another hour or so. Okay. So the sentence type interrogative relates to the speech act of a question, or an inquiry. And then at some stage, the person might say, the lecturer might say, the lecture is finished. Okay, that's a declarative. And it performs the speech act just as we've seen before, with the train that left from platform, whatever, at 11:24, it's an assertion. And this is actually something that happens quite often, that there is a clear correlation between, let's say, a declarative and an assertion. Okay? Between the form and the function, or between the form and the force that's associated with uttering that sentence in context. Okay. But the important point, and this was, for example, shown in the Silk Air incident, is that there doesn't necessarily have to be such a direct connection between form and what it does, what the force of it is. Let's have a look at this. If someone utters the following imperative, give me a hand, okay, what's the speech act here? Can you give me a hand? Interrogative, what's the speech act? Or a declarative, I can't do this alone. A declarative, okay. So we have the same kind of three different sentence types, but do we again have the same speech acts? Well, quite obviously not. What is give me a hand? It's a request, okay, or a command perhaps, but let's say it's a request, okay. Can you give me a hand? Request. I can't do this alone. Yes, it's an assertion on some level, but in the right context, the person standing, I don't know, I'm just about to walk up a ladder and hang up a lamp or something like that, and then I say, I can't do this alone. It's a request for help. And usually, the communicative partner will understand it as such. So there seems to be a mismatch between sentence type and typically associated speech act. We can also look at the same sentences and we can think about how direct the speech act is. Okay. If I say, give me a hand, if I utter the sort of order almost to do this, this is very direct. If I ask, can you give me a hand? Literally, are you physically able to give me a hand? Well, not physically able to give me a hand, but I mean to help me, okay? Then that's more indirect, right? Because basically what I'm doing is I'm asking a question about the ability of the person rather than directly commanding or, well, yeah, that help be given. And I'm sure you agree that if I make a statement like, I can't do this alone, then I'm much more indirect. In fact, I'm so indirect, and we will come back to that term again next week when we talk about politeness theory, well, that is almost off record. What's meant by this? Off record in the sense that I can say, no, I never meant what you thought I was saying. If I say, I can't do this alone, and you say, you know I can't help you, I have a problem with my back. I say, oh yeah, I know, I was just saying I can't do this alone. Okay, so I can, in a way, deny having performed the speech act that I, well, was interpreted as performing. Here is another example of this, which shows this quite nicely. Oh no, I forgot to bring my wallet. What does this mean? Well, basically it meant that I forgot to bring my wallet, but my communicative partner has quite obviously reinterpreted this, or not reinterpreted it, understood this in a different way, okay, as a request for support, financial support. Not again, this is the second time this week that you're asking me for money. Hey, I didn't ask you for money, I just said that I forgot to bring my wallet. Okay. So off-record speech acts can be, technical term is cancelled. I can deny ever having performed this. Okay. We will return to this late, as I said, next week, and I will ask the question why we do this. Okay. But at the moment, it is particularly important to see that it can be done. Just basically to look ahead a little bit, we can already mention a few points, namely that there is a connection between directness and politeness. Okay. Indirectness is in one way of being linguistically polite. Okay. Linguistic politeness is particularly important in connection with three variables. Okay. Power, social distance, and size of imposition. Okay. What is meant by size of imposition? Well, if I asked you whether you'd be happy to lend me €5 till next week, then that's not a big imposition. You probably think it's a bit odd, but I could probably convince a few of you to give me 5 euros till next week. Okay? If I did the same with 2,000 euros or 20,000 euros, I think it would be very difficult for me to find someone in this audience. Okay? So it's a completely different imposition, even if you have 20,000 euros on your account, okay? Assuming that this is the case. Okay. Social distance. If I were to just walk up to one of you who I don't know very well, I would use, this would be a different situation from asking my father, my best friend, or someone I know very, a very close relationship. Okay. And the difference in power as well, whether it's, let's say, a boss-employee relationship, or whether we are talking about two people being on the same level, also has an impact on what kind of strategies I use. Okay. But as I said, we'll be doing this next week. Politeness is also something that's culture dependent, and maybe some of you have seen the following thing on, I think, Claire Fielder's door, okay, which is in a way, well, it builds on the cliches that we have of what British society is, well, let's say, supposed to be or used to be, I don't know. And this does have to do with politeness theory, as we will see next time. There are two options when you're drowning. You can shout for help, which is wrong, as it says here. Or you can also be, doing it the right way, the English right way. Excuse me, sir, I'm terribly sorry to bother you, but I wonder if you would mind helping me a moment, as long as it's no trouble, of course. And the English man is very happy, of course, to then help. Now, the point is, of course, that the linguistic material being used is a lot more elaborate, okay, and we will have to ask the question why this is the case. Okay, to lead back to our discussion of how meaning is conveyed beyond the sort of propositional content of utterances, I'd like to look at different ways of doing the same thing, namely getting someone to close the door. You can do this in a very, very direct way. Okay? You can just basically say, close the door. You can start thinking about who would be able to do something like that. This would not be appropriate in every situation. Here's the same thing in a statement. I want you to close my door, not close the door. Okay. Again, still very direct, but now done with a different linguistic form. I'd be much obliged if you closed the door. Can you close the door? Notice now we're getting more indirect. It's now a question about the physical ability of closing the door, in a way, on the surface. Of course it isn't. It's still a request for closing the door. Are you able, by any chance, to close the door? Would you mind closing the door? Would you be willing to close the door? Variations of the same theme, basically. Okay. Again, the same message, but done differently. Here perhaps some level of irony or sarcasm or something like that is expressed. It might help to close the door. Okay. Or you can go overboard and say, would you mind awfully if I was to ask you to close the door? Again, you can think about who would say something like this in what context. Context is the most important word here. Context is decisive of almost anything in relation to pragmatics. Did you forget the door? Okay. We are moving further away from the original propositional meaning, but we're still having the same result, namely it's a speech act, a request for closing the door. Do us a favor with the door, love. Okay. Now it gets more and more extreme. How about a little less breeze? Okay. Has absolutely nothing to do with closing the door, one would think, but quite clearly the conversational partner will, in the right context, interpret this. The last two are my favorite ones. Now, Johnny, what do big people do when they come in? Okay. Clearly there is no connection between the original meaning or the propositional meaning of these words put together in the sentence and close the door. And the final one, really good. Okay, Johnny, what am I going to say next? Okay. It works, okay? I can, absolutely, yes. So things that you say all the time to your children because they forgot again to do this. Johnny, what am I going to say next? And then it's clear what I'm doing. Okay? But I think this is an extreme example, but it quite nicely demonstrates yes, there is no direct relationship between form and force or form and function. The basic meaning of an utterance may be very different from what it sort of also in inverted commas actually means in the sense of the propositional content. And I've already said it a few minutes ago, context is everything. Given the right context, a word can mean, not a word, an utterance can mean everything, anything. Okay? If I formulate the right context, then it's 3 o'clock, and this is a silly example, can mean that I bought a Ferrari yesterday. I think it would be very difficult to come up with such a context, but, well, I'm not sure whether it would actually be difficult. It might be, I haven't tried, okay? But the point is simply that, given the right context, and basically previous knowledge of the conversational partners, of what has happened in the conversation so far, something like it's 3 o'clock could mean something apparently entirely unrelated. Okay. Good. Let's move over to a difficult term, entailment, okay. Which is related which is part of the whole speech act theory business. Entailment. What is entailment? Well, if I say that Ian drives a Toyota, okay. Toyota, we know, is a company that makes cars. Okay. I don't know whether Toyota makes anything else than cars in the terms of sort of vehicles that move. Okay. They also make all sorts of other things, but primarily they make cars. If I then make the statement, make the utterance, Ian drives a car, then I can say something about the relationship between those two sentences. Okay. If I say A, then I am also at the same time, in a way, saying B. Okay. A entails B. Whenever A is true, B must be true. Well, on the assumption that Toyotas are not, I don't know, motorbikes or something like that. Otherwise, that wouldn't be true. Okay. Is it true that if I say B, then I automatically say A? Ian drives a car. Ian drives a Toyota. No, obviously not. There are lots of other makes. I'm sure Toyota would be very happy if it was actually entailing A, but that's not the case. Now, what does that mean for a speech situation where I'm talking to someone? We can look at the hearer's point of view and the speaker's point of view. From the point of the hearer that hears something like Ian drives a Toyota, then the conclusion that Ian drives a car can be drawn very confidently. There is no way that it could be different. If you hear and believe X and X entails Y, then concluding Y is completely safe. This is the hearer's point of view. From the speaker's point of view, I'm actually making a commitment, right? Okay. The entailment is a commitment towards something that is that I cannot just say doesn't exist, doesn't hold. If I claim that something is X, okay, and X entails Y, then you can't simultaneously deny Y without contradicting yourself. If I say Ian drives a Toyota, but he doesn't drive a car, well, the only way to interpret this is that Toyota has started producing things that are not cars, but still can be used to drive. Okay. And as I've already said, entailment doesn't usually go both ways. Now, why am I telling you all of this? There's smoke coming from that house. That house is on fire. Is that an entailment? Okay, why no?
Because someone is standing at the window smoking.
Okay, some rather heavy smoker and lots of sort of, yeah, okay, yeah. There might be a smoking party in there, yes, okay. Or, I don't know, someone was cooking and whatever. That could be the beginning of a fire, but it's not on fire yet, okay. Or someone's shooting a film, okay. They've got one of these nice machines that make, smoke, but it still doesn't mean that the house is actually on fire. So it's not the kind of logical relationship that we had before, where I'm committing myself to be, there is a very good chance that it is on fire. Okay? But in fact, even when you think this is the case, it might actually be wrong. Once in my former place in Lancaster, I really smelt something that looked, and I saw smoke coming from a house. Okay? And it smelled of burnt plastic, and I thought, I better ring the doorbell. And then a rather annoyed man opened the door, and I said, "Is your house on fire?" I said, "No, I'm just burning something in my." So I felt silly after that, but it just smelled very suspicious to me. Okay. So in other words, I interpreted the sign that there was smoke and smell as that house being on fire. But it isn't an entailment, as I found out. Okay, it's a reasonable assumption. I'm drawing an inference. Okay, or as people call it, this was basically drawing an implicature. Okay. So I'm reading something into a fact. I'm interpreting it. I'll give you another example of an actual language use. Which can be interpreted, and for which there is a standard interpretation. If, let's say, I'm organizing a party, in this case actually it's Sandy who's organizing a party, and Sandy says, "We need someone to make some sort of fruit salad for the picnic." And then Tom says, "I can make my family's favorite fruit salad." What does Sandy assume? What's the implicature here? Mm-hmm. That he's going to do it. Okay, I can. And it's interpreted as an offer. Okay, and Sandy will take this up and say, "Great, could you make, I don't know, 10 portions or something like that?" Yes, but is something else implied? Are there more implicatures? Is Tom communicating more than just that he's going to do it?
Hmm?
Exactly, yes. It's going to be good. You're going to like it. Okay, my family likes it. Now, it could be this is an extremely weird family. Okay, they have, I don't know, or it's whatever. But the assumption is that, yes, it's going to be a success. Okay, that's one thing. Another implicature is there as well. Anything else? Has Tom done it before? It's sort of a reasonable assumption that Tom at least has a certain expertise. It's going to be good. It's going to work out. It's going to work out the way it usually works out when my family eats it. Okay. When it turns out that actually it's usually the mother or the brother or whoever doing it, and he's doing it for the first time, that's not what we expected. Mm-hmm. Now, it actually turns out that it was a miserable thing. I mean, everyone threw up afterwards, or I don't know. It was terrible, and Sandy's obviously very annoyed because Tom spoiled the party. Then he can say, "Oh, sorry, I mean, my family likes it. I don't know, you're weird." Or, yeah, I know, when my mom does it, it's really good, but I didn't tell you, but I've never done it myself. Okay? And that's nothing that's incompatible with the speech act or with the utterance, "I can make my family's favorite fruit salad." Okay? So quite obviously, there are ways to interpret things in context. We make sense of them in context, and we read meanings into sentences, utterances, or whatever you want to call them, that may or may not be actually true, or may or may not reflect reality. We draw inferences, we interpret implicatures. Okay. Now, the person to look at how this works was Paul Grice. And here we're talking about lectures that were delivered in the 60s, in 1967. They were only partially published, but they were, again, very influential for the study of pragmatics and speech acts in particular. And the question is basically, well, what I've already said, how is it possible to mean more than what is actually said? Said in inverted commas, that is, more than what is literally expressed by what we associate with the semantics of the individual words, with the conventional sense of the linguistic expressions uttered. And I'd like to look at this in a little bit more detail with you now. Okay. Today there will be a short break, but I'm going to have to put it a little bit further into the second half. These are famous sentences or famous exchanges that Paul Grice himself used to exemplify what he means. Can you tell me the time? Well, the milkman has come. Okay. Is that telling the time? No. Okay, but it is telling the time if you know enough, if you know the right context. Okay. What it really is on one level, of course, is that the first one is an expression, it's a question. Do you have the ability to tell me the time, if you take it literal? And then we have some kind of pragmatically interpreted particle, that's this well, okay, what's the meaning of well? We'll talk about things like that in lecture 14. The milkman came at some time prior to the time of speaking. Okay, and that will help us deduce something. Or let's be a little bit more elaborate. Do you have the ability to tell me the time of the present moment, as standardly indicated on the watch, and if so, please do tell me? No, I don't know the exact time of the present moment, but I can provide some information from which you may be able to deduce the approximate time, namely, the milkman has come. Okay. And that seems to be going on, whether it's exactly like this, but something like this seems to be going on when we communicate. And we have no problems with this. Okay, that was the first example. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about the fact that we have a sort of a basic meaning of words, but then possibly something else that's on top of the basic meaning. What's the meaning of and? Well, any ideas? What's the meaning of and? You're not usually asked questions like that. You have to explain meanings of nouns and things like that. Yes?
I think it's adding one thing to another, maybe one word to another, one sentence to another.
Okay, adding or, yeah? Okay, both parts are equal. Good, yeah? Okay, so you use that coordinating conjunction to coordinate two things that are equal, to add on to a list or something like that. Okay. The Lone Ranger jumped on his horse and rode into the sunset. Yeah? The capital of France is Paris and the capital of England is London. Does and mean the same thing? Okay, while the second one is basically just combining two equal parts of a sentence. Okay, so that means that and is polysemous. Okay, remember I introduced polysemy. So we would really have to have two dictionary entries for and. One is just sort of a neutral structural combination of two. Don't write this down yet. This is wrong. Okay. It doesn't really make sense. The point will be in a minute. Okay. I don't think and is actually polysemous. By the way, how can you show this? The Lone Ranger rode into the sunset and jumped on his horse. No, that doesn't work. Okay? You can say the capital of England is London and the capital of France is Paris. So quite clearly, and isn't the same here. And means and then. Right? While in the second case, it just means I'm combining to, well, it basically means and. Okay. Another example in this context. These might seem like contrived examples to you, but they make, I think, the point quite nicely. What's the meaning of white? If I say the flag is white, well, we know what it means. There is a flag which is fully white. If I say the flag is white, red, and blue, then the white doesn't mean fully white anymore, but it now means partially white. Okay? And yes, there is an element of the flag which is fully white, but that's only part of the whole flag. You sort of think, yeah, of course, yeah, but the point that Grice makes is, and here is a quote, treating such instances as ambiguities will result in an endless proliferation of senses. So, claiming that they are polysemous, that these words are polysemous, doesn't really make sense, because then we have a language full of polysemies, and that doesn't make sense. Rather, natural language expressions tend to have simple, stable, and unitary senses, but this stable semantic core often has an unstable, context-specific pragmatic overlay. Okay? Again, the word complex, context, namely a set of implicatures. So, and means the same thing in and, well, the two capitals and the fact that, first the mounting the horse and then the riding, but there is an additional element of meaning which we can sort of imply from the context that, well, obviously you need to do one first and then the other. Now, how does this really work that we deduce the right things in that context? And that's what Paul Grice tried to explain with what's known as the cooperative principle. Okay. Grice thinks that there is, well, a basic principle which governs basically all of our conversation. And these are sort of overarching assumptions. And these assumptions are, instantiated in four maxims. And those four maxims together can be used to they express the cooperative principle. Okay. Thank you. Now here's the cooperative principle first. This is the overall assumption. Make your conversational contribution such as is required at the stage at which it occurs, by the accepted purpose or direction of the talk exchange in which you are engaged. Okay? It'll make sense in a minute. Okay. Four maxims. In order to do this, okay, to make your conversational contribution such as is required at the stage, you are supposed to, and I'm saying this with very, very large inverted commas, as I will make clear in a minute, you're supposed to be following those four maxims. The maxim of quantity. Usually in this context I ask whether you can detect a joke by Grice in all of this. Let's see whether you can do this. There is something which I think he added tongue-in-cheek. I'm not sure whether it's true, but that's my impression. The maxim of quantity. Make your contribution as informative as is required for the current purposes of the exchange. Okay. Say as much as is needed. Okay. Do not make your contribution more informative than is required. Okay. So basically, don't say too little, don't say too much, just say what's needed. And then you have followed, you've taken care of the maxim of quantity. Maxim of quality. Try to make your contribution one that is true. Don't lie. Okay? Do not say what you believe to be false. Or do not say that for which you lack adequate evidence. Okay? if you claim something which you do not know to be true, but, well, yeah, then don't say it. The maxim of relation. Oh, by the way, any jokes so far? No, obviously not, because otherwise I would have... maxim of relation, very short and brief, be relevant. Mm-hmm. No joke? No, okay. Maxim of manner, be perspicuous, meaning avoid obscurity of expression, avoid ambiguity, and be brief, or in other words, avoid unnecessary prolixity. And be orderly. Where's the joke? How many of you have heard the word prolixity before? Anyone? Yeah, I think that's the joke. I mean, what does it mean? It basically means don't say things, well, don't be wordy, be brief. So he's saying twice the same thing, which I think is a nice example of violating the maxim of manner. Which I think brings me very quickly to the point that these are, and this is a very important point, these are not things that you have to follow in order to be cooperative. In fact, you as speakers, or we as speakers of the language, constantly flout these maxims. But the point is that when we do this, we still assume that we do this while being cooperative. Okay, I'd like to explain that in a bit more detail. Let's perhaps try to look at this by going back to what I showed you towards the end of last lecture, where Calvin was ruining the coffee table of the family. Okay, first we see him hammering away, and the mother, obviously not too happy about it, comes and asks, "What are you doing to the coffee table?" What is the meaning of "what are you doing to the coffee table"? Yeah?
Stop it.
Stop it, yes. How do we know? Well, we could say, is the mother actually following all the maxims? Is there anything, is there any maxim which you could say is in some way not followed? Is she lying? No. Okay, she's not saying the untruth. But why does he look like that on at the table and sort of wonders why is she asking? Well, she's sort of, I mean, why do you ask that stupid question? You see what I'm doing. Okay? But that's not the way you would usually interpret it, and that's why this is funny, okay? Because he takes it to be a direct question. But what we would normally interpret this to mean is, well, it is so obvious, the mother sees what I'm doing, why is she still saying that? Why is she in a way saying more than that's needed? I mean, yeah. She must mean something different. Okay. So in a way, by violating or by flouting or by going against the maxim of quantity, or perhaps even relevance, you can almost always say relevance, okay. This can then be interpreted to mean something else on the basis of the assumption that both the mother and Calvin are cooperative in their conversation. Now the joke here is that Calvin isn't cooperative. Okay? But normally that's how it would work. Okay, some people distinguish, this is not an originally sort of Gricean distinction, but some people distinguish between standard implicatures and others. So if someone says, and again these are examples from Grice himself, "I've just run out of petrol," and the other person says, "Oh, there's a garage just around the corner," then this is something which is almost conventionalized, okay? And the implicature drawn is, the garage isn't closed and hasn't sold out of petrol, otherwise the speaker would not be cooperative. Next one. An example of, oh yes, and this was, no, sorry. Okay, now I got confused. But anyway. Another implicature which demonstrates the maxim of quantity. If I make the claim, Nigel has 14 children, what's the implicature? How do I understand this? When I go and visit Nigel, how many children do I see? 14, right? Mm-hmm. But logically speaking, this is compatible with a statement where Nigel has 17 children. Okay, it's contrived, but theoretically possible because, yeah. So the standard implicature is Nigel has only 14 children. Okay. Exactly 14 children. And if I say the flag is white, then the implicature is the flag is wholly white and does not contain other colors. Maxim of relevance. If I say past assault, then the implicature is that I want it now. Okay? Past assault now. As we will see later on when we look at discourse analysis in lecture 14, then we will see that these kind of basic assumptions about the adjacency of certain utterances in conversation and of sort of commands or requests like that is something that is very fundamental, that we simply rely on those very standard implicatures. So such inferences are fundamental to our sense of coherence in discourse. If the implicatures were not constructed on the basis of the assumption of relevance, many adjacent utterances in conversation would appear quite unconnected. And in fact, the exercise I did last time with the row of wooden cages and the dog and the father, etc., in a way assumes that this is all relevant. And that's why we then create the context out of it. Okay. But as I said, this will be part of lecture 14. Now, if I want someone to open the door, and we've seen that there are many ways of, well, that was closing the door, but I guess we could do the same thing for opening the door, I can do it in a very direct way, very short way, but I could also say, walk up to the door, turn the door handle clockwise as far as it'll go, and then pull gently towards you. I am conveying exactly the same thing in a way. Okay. But of course I'm conveying something else. It's not just that. I'm also saying, well, what am I saying? Be particularly careful. Pay attention. Because, I don't know, for whatever reason, but the fact that I'm using many, many more words than I would usually use for that kind of purpose will be interpreted as meaning something. In this case, pay particular attention. Now these were sort of standard implicatures, but they're also ways of really sort of going against the principles or the maxims, those were maxims, or as it is called, flouting them, violating them. Okay. Queen Victoria was made of iron. Well, quite obviously not. She was a human being. Okay, so I'm lying. Okay. But this is very, well, easy to interpret. This is interpreted as, well, Queen Victoria lacked the definitional properties of iron. Obviously not. She wasn't made of metal. Okay. But she had some of the sort of additional or incidental properties, like, well, we know iron is hard. Okay. Resilience, non-flexibility, or durability. So that would be, in a way, uncooperative. I'm telling the untruth, but we interpret it to mean something else because I know the speaker is cooperative. As an interesting aside, by the way, is this something positive or negative that Queen Victoria was made of iron? It really depends on the view of the speakers involved. Someone who's an admirer of the Queen might think this is a positive thing, and someone who suffered from under her reign might say, yeah, it was a really bad thing because she was she was made of iron. Okay. So again, context and the participants in the conversation, etc., make a big difference. Quantity. What's flouted here? Well, I'm basically saying too much, or in a way I'm saying the obvious. Both parts refer to the same propositional content. War is war. Yeah, of course, war is war. Either John will come or he will not. Yes. Obviously. If he does it, he does it. Again, yeah, sure. But why are we saying things like that? Because both parts have, if we go back to the question of whether something is true or not, both have the same truth conditions. They're expressing the same thing. Okay? But of course what we mean is something in addition to this. War is a terrible thing, or war is a terrible situation, terrible things happen, and unfortunately this is normal. Okay? I don't care whether John will really come. Okay? So again, that is an implicature drawn on something which doesn't really make sense as a statement as such, but on the assumption that the speaker is cooperative, I am drawing the right implicature. And here's another one, that's now flouting the maxim of relevance. I do think Mrs. Jenkins is an old windbag, don't you? Again, this is a famous example. You could answer, yeah, sure, she's really terrible, yeah, okay. Or if something else happens, then you as a speaker, if you are A, you're wondering, hey, what's going on? Ooh, lovely weather for March, isn't it? Can you make sense of this? You can make sense of this in the sense of, well, probably she's just sort of, well, behind that door, or her cousin has just come in, or whatever. Okay. And something which is absolutely irrelevant in response to the previous message is interpreted in such a way that it makes perfect sense. Okay. Sometimes you can even do this with gestures, but let's not go into detail there. You can say one thing and then the other person says, well, happened recently to me. But I mean, I think let's stick to words and let's leave it at that. Okay. Sorry, this was confusing. I apologize. I hereby apologize for confusing you further. Okay. So, in other words, B's utterance is made relevant in context. Okay, that was the third example of flouting a maxim. Here is, if I counted correctly, the fourth one, maxim of manner. Let's get the kids something. Let's say you're going to, I don't know, Disney World or something like that. Let's get the kids something. Okay, but I veto I-C-E-C-R-E-A-M-S. That is really produced in a very, very odd manner. Okay, if you have children, or if you are, I don't know, involved with in some way of looking after children, you of course know what's going on here. The message is, I'm using this very odd way of producing, well, why am I spelling the individual letters out? I don't want ice cream mentioned directly in the presence of the children, as this may prompt them to demand some. Okay? It works as long as the children can't spell very well, then it stops. Okay, I'll give you two more examples, and I think I'm actually going to finish a little bit early today, bad timing, but you're probably not going to be too angry about that. Okay, good. Right, interpreting speech acts. I sort of skipped over the exercise that I wanted to. I could give you this as an exercise, but let's do it together, or maybe let's not even dissect this, let's just look at this. Will you marry me? You lack confidence. You're clumsy, and let's be honest, you're not the brightest bulb around. And then leaves. Is that a yes or a no? Okay. You could now say, okay, something is flouted, she should say yes or no, and in fact she's much more informative than it would call for in this situation. And this is an obvious indication that the implicature has to be drawn, that the answer is, well, no, okay, but he doesn't seem to be the brightest bulb around, okay? Or, let's look at this one. I'm going outside. Are you done with your homework? Yes. You read that whole chapter? Let's just leave it that I'm done. Okay? Back to your room, Buster. Okay. Now, of course, we could say that this is a question of polysemy again. What does it mean to be done? Okay, it can mean several things. But of course, this is also language used in context. And if the question is asked in this right context, really there shouldn't be any misinterpretation of which of the two meanings is meant. Are you finished? Okay, but he takes it to mean as something different, namely, have you decided it's been enough? Okay, now, this may have looked rather technical to you, all those sort of words like entailment, implicature, the cooperative principle, and the fact that you have to follow these maxims, although I have made it, I hope, very clear that the idea is not that you have to follow those maxims in order to be successful conversational partners. In fact, we constantly violate those maxims, but it doesn't matter because the conversational partners assume that it would still make sense. Okay. Now, this principle is also something that, well, apart from the fact that we use it constantly when we speak to each other, is also something that underlies a lot of advertising. Language in advertising relies on the fact that we interpret, that we draw the right implicatures. Okay. Let's have a look at this. 1/3 less salt. Okay. This was a slogan, or this was an advertising that Campbell's Soup was using some time ago. What is the implicature? What are we as potential buyers of the soup supposed to read into this? Hmm? Yeah? Fight it out amongst yourself. Yeah, okay, that we need to have that basic knowledge that if there is less salt, then that's healthy, but I mean, okay. Right, okay, that's one interpretation, and therefore it's good for you, okay? But less salt, I mean, you could say, is that the same thing that you wanted to say? Less salt than what?
Than the others.
Than the others, yes. Than the other makers of soups, which and those soups are much less healthy for you. Or, in fact, there was a Campbell's soup earlier on, but now we've refined our things, we get the same taste, but it's got less salt, and therefore you must now buy it, okay? Does it actually say that? Of course not. Yeah? It is not necessarily 1/3 less salt than it used to have, or 1/3 less salt than the others, but 1/3 less salt than something. Yeah? And that something could be the Great Salt Lake, theoretically. Okay? Since this is not a relationship of entailment, but basically we're drawing the right implicature, okay, and later, if let's say we get, I don't know, salt poisoning from eating too much Campbell soup, it'll be very difficult to sue them because they didn't say it wasn't the Great Salt Lake. Okay. Engineered like no other car in the world. Okay, Mercedes. What's the implicature here? Hmm? It's special, it's better, and no other car maker can make cars the way we can do. Okay? But in a way, on a very simple and direct interpretation, well, yes, obviously, because this screw is there, well, the others do put the screw somewhere else, and it's a Mercedes, after all. It's not, an Audi or whatever. Okay? So yes, of course, it's not engineered like any other car in the world, but the implicature that's drawn is, of course, something different. This may be one of the most powerful cars in the world. Okay. But then again, maybe not. Okay. The use of modal verbs, etc., is very important in our interpretation of advertisements or of drawing the right implicatures. Okay. And that brings me to my conclusion, which is a bit early, as I said, but anyway. I made the point that you can do with languages, You can do something with language. You can do something in the sense of actually performing things. Okay? And I made the point at the beginning of the lecture that you can use special verbs for this. But then Austin qualified this and said, in fact, all utterances are speech acts. I also made the point that speech acts do not always correspond to related sentence types. Okay? An imperative is not necessarily always a command. And when they do not correspond, then indirectness arises. Okay. I've also made the point that indirectness correlates to some extent with politeness, of which, as I've said, we will hear much more next time. There will be some reading for this as well, which I'll upload today. And then, very importantly, communication relies on the assumption that speakers are cooperative, and cooperative does not mean follows all maxims of conversation that are in the cooperative principle, but if they are flouted, if they are for some reason not taken care of, then we assume that the speakers are still cooperative and therefore need to use this as a hint to towards finding the right interpretation. And I've now noticed that there is no slide saying "see you next Friday." I'm sure you'll miss. Maybe I couldn't think of another way to sort of introduce this, but there will be one next time. Okay, see you next week.